Thank you for listening to Enabled this week. I am always looking for new sources of information to use in this program. Today I'm trying out a brand new one. The website is called The Conversation, and they say it provides academic rigor and journalistic flair. Now, a big note here, it is a website from the United Kingdom, with articles specially chosen for the United States. All the articles are written by professors and other staff people from respected universities around the UK. They have a newsletter, and in it, they claim to provide fact-based journalism written by experts. I have picked out some articles that I hope will be of interest to you. The source for today's program is www.theconversation.com, Academic Rigor, Journalistic Flair. The first article I've chosen is titled, Do Blind People Have Better Hearing? This was written by Lowes Van Dam, who's a lecturer in psychology at the University of Essex in the UK. The article starts, The sensation of sound occurs when the vibrations from sounds enter our ear and cause little hair-like structures, they're called hair cells, within our inner ear to move back and forth. The hair cells transform this movement into an electrical signal that the brain can use. How well a person can hear largely depends on how intact these hair cells are. Once lost, they don't grow back. And this is no different for blind people. So, people who are blind can't physically hear better than others. Yet, people who are blind often outperform sighted people in hearing tasks such as locating the source of sounds. The reason for this emerges when we look beyond our sensory organs at what is happening with the brain and how the sensory information is processed by it. Perception occurs when the brain interprets signals that our sensory organs provide, and different parts of the brain respond to the information arriving from different sensory organs. There are areas that process visual information, which is called the visual cortex, and areas that process sound information, called the auditory cortex. But when a sense like vision is lost, the brain does something remarkable. It reorganizes the functions of these brain areas. In people who are blind, the visual cortex gets a bit, bored without visual input, and it starts to rewire itself. It becomes more responsive to information from the other remaining senses. So blind people may have lost their vision, but this leaves a larger brain capacity for processing the information from the other senses. At this point in the article, they have inserted a picture showing the location of the visual cortex in the back lower part of the brain. The article continues by saying, the extent of reorganization in the brain depends on when someone loses their sight. The brain can reorganize itself at any point in life, including adulthood, but during childhood, the brain is more able to adapt to change. This is because during childhood, the brain is still developing, and the new organization of the brain does not have to compete with the existing one. As a result, people who have been blind from a very early age show a much greater level of reorganization in the brain. People who become blind early in life tend to outperform sighted people, as well as those who become blind later in life, in hearing and touch perceptual tasks. Next, there's a section in this article about echolocation. That's all one word, echolocation. The reorganization in the brain also means that blind people are sometimes able to learn how to use their remaining senses in interesting ways. For example, some blind people learn to sense the location and size of objects around them using echolocation by producing clicks with their mouths. Clicks with their mouths and listening for the echoes, blind people can locate objects in their surroundings. This ability is tightly linked with the brain activity in the visual cortex. In fact, the visual cortex in blind echolocators responds to sound information in almost the same way as it does to visual information in people who are sighted. In other words, in blind echolocators, hearing has replaced vision in the brain to a very large extent. But not every blind person is automatically an expert echolocator. Whether a blind person is able to develop a skill like echolocation depends on the time spent learning this task. Even sighted people can learn this skill with enough training, but blind people will probably benefit from their reorganized brain being more tuned toward the remaining senses. Blind people will also rely more on their remaining senses to do everyday tasks, which means that they train their remaining senses on a daily basis. The reorganized brain, together with a greater experience in using their remaining senses, are believed to be important factors in blind people having an edge over sighted people in hearing and touch. Well, the next article is titled, Blind Academic, I Don't See What You Mean, So Let's Find New Metaphors for Knowledge. This was written by David Bolt, who's an associate professor at the Liverpool Hope University in the United Kingdom. He starts out by saying, as somebody who has been registered as blind for 3 decades, I am still startled by the array of presumptions faced by people who have visual impairments. A couple of my own anecdotes share just how likely it is for blind people to be presumed to be either unemployed or unemployable. I recall taking a break from working on my recent book on literary representations of blindness to meet a friend for a few drinks at a bar in the city center. I allowed 30 minutes for the taxi journey, but because of an unexpectedly low volume of traffic, I arrived 20 minutes early. Because the bar was noisy, making it difficult for me to order a drink and find somewhere to sit, I decided to wait outside with my guide dog. After 10 minutes or so, someone walked past, paused, and then turned backwards toward me. I stepped forward slightly in case it was my friend, but it was a stranger, who indicated in a friendly tone that he was trying to hand me something. I assumed it must have been a flyer of some description. Print hasn't been accessible to me for many years, so I didn't raise my hand to take it. This has become my standard little protest. The stranger seemed puzzled by my lack of engagement with his gesture, paused again before asking, "Aren't you collecting for the blind?" At that point, though not in a can or a hat, a proverbial penny dropped for us both. I explained that I was just waiting for someone, and the stranger apologized profusely as he walked away. I've had this experience more than once, and it's nothing short of hilarious on one level, but it also shows how presumptions can intervene on a day-to-day basis, perhaps conjuring up the blind beggar, who is a well-known figure in literature, film, art, and so on. The stranger evidently saw me as someone bound to be seeking money. And the next section of the same article is called, Yes, I Work Here. He says, on another occasion, I recall standing in the university's senior commons room, waiting to satisfy my desire for coffee, when someone joined me in the queue. We chatted for a few minutes, and it became clear that he thought I must have been a student rather than a lecturer. This presumption is noteworthy because it's been made about me by other people and at other institutions. In general, I found that until students get to know me, it doesn't cross their minds that I might be employed by the university. Indeed, some of my students have admitted that upon first spotting me on campus, they're surprised that someone who can't see can be a student, let alone a lecturer. For some people, the idea of an educator without sight is a contradiction in terms. Perhaps one origin of this presumption is the commonplace confusion between seeing and knowing, such as in the phrase, "Do you see what I mean?" After all, to confuse seeing and knowing in this way leads to the idea that not seeing is much the same as not knowing, such as in the saying, "blind to the facts." I'm not suggesting we drop all language that uses sight to represent knowledge. Who am I to throw out perfectly respectable words like perspective, enlighten, illuminate, insight, speculate, and so on? But I do think we should change this age-old emphasis on sight and find new metaphors for knowledge. My 2 anecdotes might seem rather mundane, but they chime with a social issue of great importance. The fact is that, according to an organization called Action for Blind People, 4 out of every 6 individuals who have visual impairments are unemployed. The media's focus on benefit fraudsters would have us believe this is down to a lack of effort on the part of the individuals themselves. But speaking from experience of employment and long-term unemployment, I'd argue that by far the biggest obstacle is the array of presumptions faced on a day-to-day basis by people who have visual impairments. The next article, filled with information from the UK, from the website www.theconversation.com, this one is titled "How a Blind Artist is Challenging Our Understanding of Color." This was written by Simon Hayhoe, who's a lecturer in education at the University of Bath in the United Kingdom. This is about an artist whose name is Esref Armaghan. I'll be giving you the spelling of that later on. The article starts out by saying, "For centuries, people who were born blind have been the intellectual curios of philosophers studying consciousness. This is particularly true for those exploring the way our consciousness is affected by our bodies, especially our eyes, which Leonardo da Vinci described as the window of the soul. One interesting fallacy is the belief that people born blind have no real idea of color. In the 17th century, for instance, the philosopher John Locke thought that parts of the world were peculiar to the individual senses. These parts could be seen in the lack of understanding of people who were blind or deaf. Similarly, David Hume believed that when the senses weren't stimulated by individual energies such as light or sound, then no ideas could ever be formed. Even in the 20th century, it was commonly believed that people born blind were unable to have a true understanding about the world around them. For instance, in 1950, the psychologist Geza Revez wrote, "No one born blind is able to become aware of the diversity of nature and to apprehend all the rich and various appearances of objects." This is in 1950. Also, philosopher Thomas Nagel felt that blind people had only the most shallow understanding of color in comparison to those people with sight. Up until the 21st century, we had little idea about how we could test our beliefs about visual concepts. But then, scientists became aware of a Turkish artist named Esref Armaghan. He was born totally blind. Armaghan has no direct visual experience. Yet he paints and draws using not only color, but also shadow, light, and perspective in his unique imaginative scenes. So how did Armaghan learn about color? The answer seems to be through a creative understanding of visual elements, through language and his remaining perceptions. The artist has strong memories of what he was told about the visual world by his father. Armaghan was often taken to this father's engineering workshop when he was a child and would ask questions about his surrounding environment. Crucially, he also had opportunities to use this knowledge. Being an engineer, his father owned a scribe, a sharp tool for scratching, cutting, and drilling points onto metal, and Armaghan used it to etch images. Armaghan's father would guide his blind son's hand over the engraved lines and describe what he saw. The young artist then practiced making these lines to represent visual edges and shading, which he showed to family members who provided feedback and more verbal descriptions. Having mastered visual ideas such as edges and shading, the teenaged Armaghan began drawing in color and continued to seek comments and feedback from those around him. He described this process to my former student, Ruth Cole, as one of learning by repetition. Here's a quote, "By asking and showing over and over again. Eventually, he switched his medium of choice to paint, recalling, I started with colored pencils and then switched to oil paints, but they took a long time to dry, so I finally discovered acrylics." Interestingly, Armaghan does not paint with watercolors because he builds layers of paint on board and paper with his fingers, letting each layer dry before he adds another. This technique allows Armaghan to sense the various colors and shades that he's creating as a substitute for actually seeing his new image. He has achieved a visual understanding through constant examination and discussion, supplemented through touch. He likens the color red with the feel of something hot, and he also uses hearing. He compares the dimming of sound as it becomes distant with his use of visual perspective. He says, "I have created my painting in my head, including colors, before I even start to paint. It's strictly memorization." Armaghan's case challenges centuries of belief about color. What's more, given the accurate descriptions provided by sighted family and friends, his work shows that it is possible for people born blind to understand, describe, and create visual pieces of art. Perhaps researchers should now be finding examples to demonstrate how people can achieve what is thought to be unachievable, rather than focusing on theorizing disability. If we can manage this, we may well further our understanding of what the human imagination is truly capable of, instead of having a poor idea of its limitations. Once again, the artist's name is Esref Armaghan. It's spelled E-S-R-E-F. His last name is Armaghan, A-R-M-A-G-A-N, if you would like to do some additional research about this amazing artist who is blind. The next article is called Curing Blindness: Why We Need a New Perspective on Sight Rehabilitation. This article was written by Mika Scheller, who is a research fellow at the University of Aberdeen in Scotland. She starts out by saying, in a society focused on visual communication, being blind can have severe disadvantages. In fact, research shows that people who are blind are at higher risk of unemployment, social isolation, and a lower quality of life than sighted people. Given the huge impact blindness has on society and those without vision, the drive to find a quote-unquote cure for blindness has become a profitable market. Many new cutting-edge developments that so-called cure blindness built on promises they often cannot keep, leaving many blind people and their families feeling disappointed and disillusioned. But what does curing blindness actually mean, and how can it be achieved in a way that it most benefits the blind person? When we think of curing blindness, we often think about restoring the lost sense, for example, through vision-enhancing technology, bionic eyes, or even gene therapy. This is because we typically treat an impaired sense by focusing on the damaged sensory organ. But while our eyes deliver the sensory input by transforming light into electrical impulses that our brains can use, most visual perception happens in the brain. The perception of a visual object, a coffee cup, let's say, is created across different hierarchical levels in the visual cortex of our brain. Simple two-dimensional features, such as edges and colors, are combined into more complex shapes, which are in turn combined into the perception of whole objects, like our coffee cup. Across these different levels, our previous visual and non-visual experiences strongly influence how we perceive the final object. Because of the complex nature of visual perception, sight is incredibly difficult to restore, and achieving a satisfactory level of visual function is not easy. Despite significant advances in visual restoration technology, even the best visual implants typically only allow a visual acuity of about 1 over 60, which is technically still classified as blindness by the World Health Organization. While this minimal form of light perception is already great progress, it's not enough to allow a person to live independently. While every blind person has their own ideas of what sight rehabilitation should do for them, what resonates with most is the aim to increase independence by allowing blind people to gain more access to visual information. But does the brain need vision for that? Not necessarily. This is why we need to adopt a different perspective on sensory rehabilitation, one that views vision as part of a greater multisensory experience. After all, perception is rarely based on one sense alone, but on a combination of multisensory experiences in which our senses influence each other. The brain has the remarkable ability to compensate for sensory loss by reorganizing how it processes information. In fact, the brain learns to perceive through the sensory experiences it makes during childhood. If all sensory experience is non-visual, perception will develop around these experiences. So, if a person was born without sight or lost their sight early on in childhood, their perception will develop around the non-visual senses. This is why, on some tasks, blind people perform better than sighted people, while on other tasks, they may perform worse. This dichotomy seems to underlie a simple principle. Is the sense that is typically used for this task the best suited for accessing this information? For example, we are well able to locate a buzzing telephone using either our vision or our hearing. In this case, more experience finding objects through sound will lead to superior performance in blind people when only hearing is used. However, given that our vision is much better suited to perceiving people's faces, blind people usually perform worse than sighted people when recognizing others' faces through touch. We know that the brain learns best about the environment when it can access the same information through multiple senses. This benefits our perception by enhancing accuracy and precision. But if we want to make use of this perceptual benefit in vision rehabilitation, we need to know whether the blind brain actually learned to generate it. It turns out that this depends on the age a person goes blind. Blindness before the age of 8 or 9 years influences how touch and hearing are used together to estimate object size. But blindness after this age impairs the ability to enhance perception through multisensory combination. So what does that mean for sensory rehabilitation? We know that there is not one best solution for all, but we also know that the age of blindness onset can provide important clues. If a person has been blind since birth or early childhood, the brain does not know how to process visual information, so vision restoration may not bring much benefit. If, however, sight was lost later in life, the brain is best wired to perceive its surroundings through vision. But there's still good news for the congenitally and early blind. The enhanced perceptual abilities in the remaining senses can be used to substitute for vision. In fact, visual information does not have to be taken up through the eyes. It can also reach the brain through our other senses. In order for that to happen, it first needs to be translated into a different sensory language. For example, visual information can be directly translated into sound. Through training, the brain then learns to use this new sensory language, opening up the visual world through the use of another sense. While sensory restoration advancements have come a long way, we are still far from an optimal solution that allows blind people to access visual information and equally partake in society. By realizing that perception depends on individual experiences, we can better develop solutions that will most benefit each person, whether that aims to restore their sight or seeks to use their other senses instead. The next article is titled "How Writing You Can Touch is Still Helping People Who Are Blind to Read and to Learn." This article was written by three people from the University of Birmingham in the UK. Graham Douglas and Mike McLinden are both professors of education, and Rachel Hewitt is a research fellow at the university. Now remember, they wrote this article in January of this year about the birthday of Braille. The article starts, "Louis Braille, who was born on January 4, 1809, invented a tactile reading and writing system which transformed the lives of countless people who had severe vision impairments or blindness. Braille was blind himself and first came up with the idea for a form of writing you can read by touch while he was still at school. The Braille code is made up of 64 characters based on a matrix of 6 raised dots, which were historically embossed on paper. Different formations of these dots can represent a single letter, a combination of letters, or even a word. For nearly 200 years, the Braille code has enabled people with vision impairments around the world to get an education. But now, technology offers visually impaired people new opportunities to access information. Today's computers and mobile devices are equipped with speech functions, which can read information aloud for people who are blind. So, some people are wondering whether Braille is still needed. Yet, based on the research we've done at the University of Birmingham's Vision Impairment Center for Teaching and Research, we would argue that technology and Braille are allies rather than competitors. The truth is, technology and Braille have always worked well together. After all, Braille's success is closely linked to the technological developments which enabled the code to be written and mass-produced. Braille writing frames, mechanical writing machines such as the Perkins Brailler, and Braille embossers, which are essentially Braille printers, have all helped to make Braille more accessible today than ever before. Many products have Braille embossed on their packaging, including groceries. And it is now a legal requirement to have Braille labels on all medicine packaging. I better insert a note here. Remember, this is coming from the UK. I don't think that's required in the US. The authors continue by saying, indeed, our own research underpins this international standard. This trend also reflects the improvements in national and international laws regarding disability. But there is no doubt that better technology has played a crucial role in opening up opportunities for people with vision impairment to enjoy greater access to information. For example, the refreshable Braille display arrived on the scene in recent decades. These Braille displays link up to computers, and they present text in a line of Braille characters, which are refreshed as the user reads each line. This portable technology has transformed the way that many visually impaired people use Braille, enabling them to read online information and communications anywhere, anytime. Braille was actually adopted very gradually around the world and has undergone many changes to its rules and conventions since Louis Braille's death. The latest technology is merely part of this evolution. Indeed, there's evidence to suggest that new technologies are actually making access to Braille easier, faster, and cheaper. This has certainly been true for participants in our ongoing longitudinal transition studies. These people have benefited from using Braille at the university for following notes during a lecture or proofreading an essay. It's one of several vital learning tools. They also wield technology such as computers and smartphones with impressive skills. In fact, the real threat to the future of Braille stems not from the emergence of new technology, but from a lack of educational resources and guidance. In the current climate where teaching services are under a great deal of financial pressure, we must ensure that Braille teaching is not neglected. Louis Braille's invention remains a potent symbol of disabled people's independence and empowerment. It is still a hugely important route to literacy for blind people. Braille can and should be used together with other technologies so that people with visual impairments can access the great wealth of information available in this digital era and learn independently. Well, there you have it, information from the United Kingdom. And I think I can say that we've had inspiration from abroad, information from academics. To end the program today, I have a quote for you to think about. Education is the most powerful weapon you can use to change the world. Nelson Mandela said this. I'm sure you know him as the former president of South Africa. But you might not know that his favorite food is probably not your favorite food. He had been wined and dined by world leaders, but what Mandela loved most was eating tripe. Yup, the stomach lining of farm animals. Thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great week.